Hello, everybody, and this is Michael. Let us continue, and we're on the sixth, second initiation compilation program. SIC, I'm calling it SIC. Anyway, sometimes I write it out. This is the 17th of June, and the year is 2018. All right. Well, we've been looking closely at a topical manner of study, and hopefully things are falling into place. We've just discussed the Ray Lords, the ones in Shambhala and the ones that are in our solar system, and looked at some interesting adjectives and wondered about the who really is the seventh ray logos. Is it Uranus? Then who is the first ray logos? Is it, if we stay with soul rays and all of this, then the third logos will be Saturn, the second will be unifying heat of the second logos will be Jupiter, and the dynamic electricity will be Vulcan. But really, whenever we mention electricity, there's the suggestion that Uranus is much involved. So let's see. Okay, hopefully this is working. Yes, as always, you know, I never quite press the right button at the right time, and hence my inability to come in at exactly 1 hour. Anyway, the electrical planet is Uranus, and by the time we get to the third, second, and first logos, and the fifth, sixth, and seventh initiation, we are really talking about the monad as the initiating factor. Whether we should be dealing with the monadic rays at the fifth, sixth, and seventh, or with soul rays, as the ray of the secondary ray of the spiritual triad does persist, I think, until the fifth initiation. But beyond that point, I just don't know. So we either deal with soul rays, which would be Saturn, Jupiter, and Vulcan, or we deal with monadic rays, which would be for the fifth initiation, Saturn, sixth, Neptune, and seventh, Uranus. And these would be the synthesizing, related to the synthesizing planets. Anyway, the adjectives are very interesting, as I've been pointing out. Magical, aggressive. Let's see, maybe why don't I underline these things? Magical, aggressive sounds very Martian, doesn't it? Illuminating, sounds of Venusian, harmonizing in one way, sounds Mercurian, blending. Well, I just don't know, you know. In one respect, the blending does relate to Mercury, but anyway, we have Saturn, and unifying certainly relates to both Jupiter and Neptune, and dynamic electricity, well, it's so Uranian, really. And we have to just really understand whether that is the case or not. But the adjectives at least give us another perspective on that which is active, forces that are active at these various initiations, and point to the logoi, or at least the seven ray lords, and then the logoi from which these forces come. Now, moving on, transmutation and the second initiation. Now, so often when we speak of the second initiation, we speak of transformation, third transfiguration, first transmutation, but some of these extend beyond that type of confinement. So the transmutated process reaches, in a way, very high and beyond, certainly beyond the first degree, when considered in a different light. The transmutative process, transmutation, is a subject that from the earliest ages has occupied the attention of students, scientists, and alchemists. You know, how to change the quality of matter, upgrade the quality of matter from the occult point of view, increase its vibration. The power to change through the application of heat, and in this case, you know, solar fire, is, of course, universally recognized. I mean, when we think of occultism, we think of solar fire as bringing about big changes, and also electric fire, even bigger changes. So this is universally recognized. But the key to the mystery, or the secret of the systemic formula related to our solar system, is advisedly guarded from all searchers and is only gradually revealed after the second initiation, when the transformation of the desire nature is occurring, when a desire is being well and truly transformed into aspiration and a great blow against selfishness is struck. We don't get rid of all selfishness, certainly not, but we do get rid of quite a bit of the Martian type of it by the time the second initiation is taken, and we are very much oriented with a keen desire to love and to serve. That is what he has said recently in some of the material we've been studying. Okay, so in some of the later rules, we have a discussion of transmutation, transformation, and transfiguration. And maybe I can, find it, possibly. Had to rearrange my computer a bit here because I couldn't see the way I should. So let's see. If I go here, and I click that hidden view and go into about 165, maybe I'll be able to see that, and maybe around page 20 there might be something. No, this has got to be clicked, and then I can do it. So maybe rule 12 or 13 of either one will be useful. Four things the disciple must learn and comprehend before it can be shown the inmost mystery. First, the law of that which radiates. The five meanings of magnetization make the second. The third is transmutation, or the secret lost of alchemy. And then lastly, the first letter of the word which has been imparted. But it gets even more specific, the hidden name egoic. Let the group reveal the hidden mystery. Let the group demonstrate the higher meaning of the lessons learned, and these are four and yet are one. Let the group understand the law of synthesis, of unity and fusion. Let the threefold mode of working with that which is dynamic, presumably the will, carry the group together towards the higher three, maybe the three Buddhas of activity, where the will of God holds sway. And this is the point. Let transfiguration follow transformation, and may transmutation disappear. Well, I think what we have there is a higher way of looking at transfiguration, transformation, and transmutation. DK in certain chapters applies these terms to the higher initiations, and not just to initiation 1, 2, and 3. So we see the transmutation does occur on still higher levels, transfiguration on still higher levels once we enter the higher type of initiatory sequences. So we can, I'm not going to get into that, right now entirely, but we can look at Rule 10 and we can look at Rule 13, and I think we will find some important things in that regard. All right, so here we go. Egoic cycles and the second initiation. These cycles, periods between, the period between egoic cycles, the mystery of the 777 incarnations, I think I probably inserted that. These cycles are one of the mysteries of initiation, though one of the earlier mysteries, and are revealed at the second initiation, if only we could remember, as they enable the initiate to comprehend his position, at least on the inner planes and within the causal body, he can do that, to see somewhat the nature of the karmic impulse, that which has to be worked out in any one life, and to read his own record in the astral light, mercifully perhaps. Not all of this is brought through onto the physical plane. But an underlying prompting probably probably exists. Okay, the mystery of the 777 incarnations. We're pretty well, when we're taking the last seven incarnations, we have entered, in a way, the program of initiation. But really, this does not complete the higher initiations at all. Interesting that 777 is the number connected with Earth particularly, and why should that be? No seventh ray is showing itself as a major ray of the planetary logos. 666 of Mars, yes, 888 of Mercury, and that makes sense considering its relation to the anticharonic pattern of the figure 8, 555 to Venus with its fifth ray soul and so forth. There are different ways of signaling the identity of these planetary logoi with three numbers. Okay. So TCF 738 might be just worth going there for a moment. The treatise on and 738. Let's see what's there. Right. The period between egoic cycles, right. And this is a, you know, powerful material. I've discussed this in writing. This is part of the period that I've discussed in writing when I was doing commentaries of a written nature. So I'm not going to go back on that. We would get, you know, really sidetracked. But it was deeply interesting and not easily understood. But all of these have to do with the development of the human being and the different kinds of lesser and greater cycles through which he moves. I mean, it's really what DK has given us here is just amazing, and I'm hoping that some years ago when I did this in writing, I dealt with the matter somewhat meticulously according to my abilities and limitations. Yeah. The planetary pralaya, gosh, I'm kind of intrigued. Or next comes the period wherein the man has attained freedom. A man has at this stage succeeded under law in abstracting himself, the freed soul, from out of the matter of the three worlds. He has used and worked with Deva substance and has gained all the vibratory contact possible and has secured all the intended realizations and revelations and can no longer be held imprisoned by the Devas. That's the mother aspect, and the imprisonment by the Devas to free oneself from certain Devas, at least, is part of the human quest. He is free until consciously and willingly, and in another round, he can return as a member of a hierarchy. A hierarchy, there are a number of them, to continue his work of service for the little evolved humanity at a distant time, and maybe that's like a fifth creative hierarchy. All this concerns the seven paths of opportunity for a master, the way of higher evolution, and how he can tread one of those paths and return as a member of a hierarchy, for instance, as a solar angel. This is the great human pralaya. And then, goodness, I'm so attracted by this. The planetary pralaya, man after these cyclic happenings, is now a conscious part of his group and a vibrant point in the center in the body of a heavenly man. He is a conscious monad, consciously alive and consciously aware of his place in the great whole. There are many forms of hierarchies within the body of a planetary logos. This involves a realization as to the center of which he is a point of energy. There may be six, seven centers on the monadic plane, but also other and higher centers cosmically considered, a knowledge of the type of force he is to transmit and to manipulate from cosmic levels. And he's still within the body of manifestation of a planetary logos, and a conscious relation with the six other centers in the planetary life with which he is associated. And that sounds, you know, well, there's always going to be six others if you're involved in one of them, and that's the case for the monad. And maybe if we move up onto the other cosmic levels, it's also the case. So we can see why it is said that a treatise on cosmic fire is basically written for initiates. And, you know, into any one of these things we could enter in depth, and we could discover, you know, things that are far beyond the capacity of the human being to think of by himself at this stage of evolution. I've tried to take some of the major books and either in writing or verbally on video to give you my impressions. Of course, Master DK is the last word on these matters, but I have hoped to offer some thoughts which help to bridge between items of knowledge with which there is no immediately indicated relation. But maybe bridges of light can be built and we can see connections which otherwise we couldn't. It's a mercurial kind of act, and eventually it's all synthesized by Jupiter. These cycles are one of the mysteries of initiation. Earlier mysteries. So we're going to learn a lot on the inner planes and the extent to which we can bring it through, or at least have that somewhat unconscious prompting within our mind that will help us rediscover the nature of the original impartation. Okay, let's go on. The action of Sanat Kumara after the second initiation. At the moment of initiation, after the second initiation, Sanat Kumara becomes the direct mouthpiece and agent of the planetary logos, at least for initiation 3, 4, and 5, that is the case. Initiation 6 involves another unnamed being, and initiation 7 involves the planetary logos himself rather than his emanation, Sanat Kumara. That great entity speaks through him. And for one brief second, if one can use such a term in connection with a plane whereon time as we understand it, and that's so important, it's not really negating time, but he's saying as we understand it, it is negated, where time as we understand it is not, the planetary logos of a man's ray consciously, via his etheric brain, turns his thought upon the initiate and calls him by his name. This sounds very monadic when we talk about the real ray of the individual. The soul ray is always a sub-ray of the true ray, which is monadic. So it depends on what initiation we're talking about. Remember, we just discussed the idea that after the second initiation, the next two initiations are taken on the ray of the monad. And certainly the fourth initiation is, there seems to be some question as to whether the third is taken on the ray of the monad, on the ray of the soul or ego, or on some combination of the two, which is also an interesting possibility. The Buddhists have some interesting art which shows these emanated possibilities and how a higher being functions through a lower and a still lower and on and on and on. You know, basically we are that very higher being in our essence, but we have lost a great deal through a deliberate self-circumscription. Maybe I can call it that. Okay, so Sanat Kumara is, and the cultivation of that which he expresses in terms of the will and light, love eternal, light supernal, peaceful, silent will. All of that begins to be appreciated once the second degree is taken and one is on, after passing certain tests, one is really on one's way to become a true initiate in a solar sense upon our planet. Okay, so what else here? Okay. Action on the petals of the egoic lotus after the second initiation. I mean, some of the, you know, it may seem that, goodness, what are we doing? We're jumping all over the place. But that's exactly the point. And when we do jump from reference to reference, new connections in thought, maybe understood, or at least shown, indicated. All right, this brings us to the third group of petals, or to the unfolding of the will or sacrifice petals based on intelligent purpose and pure love. You know, the tears which went before, the possibility of initiatory sacrifice. So the sacrifice petals are based upon whatever has unfolded in the knowledge petals, the intelligent petals, that is, and the love petals. Although a purer form of knowledge, love, and sacrificial will are found within the sacrifice petals themselves, and probably a still purer form is found within the synthesis petals, which are buddhically sourced when the causal body is created. Right. The force in this group calls in a different factor, that of the Manu. So I guess we can think that the love petals call in the force of the Bodhisattva, and the intelligence petals the force of the Mahachohan. The force of this group calls in a different factor, that of the Manu, as well as the force of the Bodhisattva, because, you know, there is a sacrificial love involved. And the desired effect is produced through the full cooperation of the fully awakened ego. We're getting more and more awake at this point, nearing the third initiation, aided by his own master, if he is evolving in a cycle wherein hierarchical effort for humanity takes the form it does in the present one, and the Manu. So there is an important triangle. So we have the Okay. Let's see, what have we got there? Manu, yeah. An important triangle is coming to the fore, and it involving the man's master, the Bodhisattva, and the Manu. Because after all, the egoic lotus really is the province of the Bodhisattva. It is related specifically to the second aspect of divinity as a whole, even though its subsidiary parts have other kinds of relations. So eventually, after the second initiation, the Lord of the world comes in as a factor operating upon the egoic lotus. The Lord of the world, Lord of world power, fully expressing itself in love. So this is a good definition, of the Lord of the world. Oh, that's light of the world. All right, Lord of the world. Let's see. This is just kind of, okay, maybe I don't have the Lord of the world, but I certainly have the light of the world here. Okay, so the Lord of the world, Sanat Kumara, will act at the third degree upon the egoic lotus, and then the knowledge petals begin to disintegrate, and we move towards contact with the monad, which basically has been called Atmabuddhi. So the next two tier petals, love and sacrifice, are important at that point. If we eliminate three, we're back to nine, you know, the synthesis petals, the sacrifice petals, and the love petals. But a gradual disintegration of knowledge per se begins to take place, and knowledge at this point begins to be transmuted into wisdom. You might want to check out my book on the Egoic Lotus. It's a video book, and I've tried to, apply meticulous entirety to the various unfoldments of the petals and the kinds of energies which can contribute to those unfoldments, and the kinds of capabilities or tendencies which appear in the man's life as the petals are unfolding. Of course, you know, I'm trying to think on my feet as I'm doing this, and some things may be correct and others incorrect, but in time, all that we offer that is not correct will be corrected. I try to say when something is strictly hypothetical. So, you know, people like ourselves who are sincere students of these books and attempting to be true disciples, before every disciple initiation looms, and the first, second, and third initiation are indicated within these sacrifice petals. So people who are part of the normal social setup and are not necessarily aspiring towards the higher occult possibilities may still be engaged with the love petals, which are pretty much related to social interaction and cohesion. But later, these sacrifice petals show us distancing ourselves from some of these more normal tendencies and achieving a degree of detachment and entering into the higher energies, and thereby sacrificing many of the lower tendencies through much difficulty. And eventually we become, you know, the true initiate of the first solar degree, which is the third initiation. We become that, and then all of the first nine petals are unfolded, with the synthesis petals on their way to bursting open just before the fourth initiation. All right, this next thing is about the state of the centers at the second initiation. Suffice it to point out that the fires at the lower centers, those below the diaphragm, have, by the time the second initiation is reached, usually mounted to the center between the shoulder blades. And this may not be be entirely the heart center. And you know, we kind of wonder how far the fires at the base of the spine have mounted by this time. Now, really, their full mounting may begin somewhere, well, it will be consummated at the fifth initiation. So initiation 3, 4, and 5 see a real rising of these fires at the base of the spine, but initiation 1 sees solar plexus to throat. Initiation 2 sees, 1 sees sacral center to the throat. Initiation 2 sees solar plexus to heart. And then it seems to take a few initiations to get the fire at the base of the spine to the top of the head. It's like a Pluto and Uranus relationship, with one being will, Pluto at the base of the spine, and the other being purpose, Uranus at the top of the head. Okay, so usually mounted to the center between the shoulder blades, at the second initiation, they rise as far as the head, at least, I guess, the fires of the sacral center, which has the mental elemental connected with it, and the fire of the solar plexus, which has the astral elemental connected with it, they rise as far as the head, and all the fires of the torso are then active. But you know, of course, it's not a completion when we're considering the center of the base of the spine. All that remains then to do is to centralize them to produce the necessary geometrical interplay between the seven head centers, I suppose, within the head and ruled by Vulcan, and then to focus them all prior to the final liberation in the highest center of all, and let's just call that the final rising of the Kundalini. So there are different ways that Master DK talks about the rising of the centers, and each one of them, the rising of the energy of the centers, and each one of them tends to aspect the other and bring new revelations. Suffice it to say, by the time we're taking the second initiation, we really aren't living below the diaphragm in the same way as the average person will do. There's a higher type of mentality in the throat center than can be found in the sacral center, where the mental elemental is found. There's a higher type of love than the desire nature that's found at the solar plexus, where the emotional elemental is, the astral elemental. So by that time, there's a considerable rising of the lower energies. And even, I suppose, the Kundalini is doing its work slowly and in manners which are not entirely charted in the knowledge of the likes of us. But eventually, when the man is coming in direct touch with the monad of the fourth degree, and then later is liberated from the debris of the causal body, which has been destroyed, then there's a straight line of energy between the basins. Excuse me, getting ahead of myself here, between the base of the spine and the highest head center. Then it is complete. All right, so the second initiation, let's just say, what can we say, a general clearing of the energies below the diaphragm. Not entirely, but mostly. Okay, and the center between the shoulder blades, you know, it might be considered kind of a pranic or a lung center. I don't think he would call it the heart center if it were, if that's what he really meant. Okay. Now let's look a little further. Okay, a little further. Neptune in the second initiation. The Neptunian, let's see, what, this is still cosmic fire. The Neptunian scheme, you know, really not much is said about it. And you can even see in the diagrams that he's just not going to reveal a whole lot about it. Let's see, there it is. See, Neptune is very generically represented, just like Uranus is, of course, probably as the highest planets in our solar system. They are the last to be fully developed. Here's a little better, sharper image that Tuya created to help us. But you can see all the geometry that's there within this larger Saturn scheme that embraces a number of the different planetary loci, but there's just no geometry to speak of when we're looking closely at the Neptune scheme and the Uranus scheme. Probably these are secrets or of mysteries of initiation, and they just can't be given out yet. Plus the idea that the development of these great entities will occur later, just the way the heart and the head center are unfolded later in the process of unfolding the human chakras. All right. So the Neptunian scheme governs one of the three paths of return. Well, you kind of wonder, you know, when you look at this, whether whether we have, I mean, here are logoi, the three logoi, but not just the planetary logoi. I think they are subsidiary cosmic logoi, or subsidiary solar logoi, and the solar logos subsumes the three, but probably the Neptune path is the middle one, and it is subsidiary to this triangle, which represents the sun, S-O-N aspect of our solar logos. This is an amazing chart, and there's lots of ways to interpret it, and I've seen many different ways offered here, and I've offered my own, you know, when it comes to the discussion in a treatise on cosmic fire. Okay, so the Neptunian scheme that's within our planetary scheme, within our planet, within our, what can I call it, within our solar system. The Neptunian scheme governs one of the three paths of return and gathers to itself eventually all those egos who attain primarily through the manipulation of the sixth type of energy called devotion. Now, that's one of the stories that has to do with the probable soul ray of Neptune, which we consider the sixth, but we're not really considering yet the monadic ray of Neptune, which he definitely tells us in Esoteric Psychology 1, page 420-421, right in there, that the esoteric ray of Neptune, which is the monadic ray, is the second, just as Uranus is the first and Saturn is the third. So six-ray souls may be gathered to Neptune once they start on the way of higher evolution and go for training and leave their planet of recent activity behind. It is the Neptunian influence, likewise, which presides over and makes possible the second initiation. I think it has a lot to do with the fourth as well, with its introduction to the focus on the Buddhi plane, and with the sixth initiation, which dissolves the magnetism which holds most of the monads onto the earth. And you know, Neptune dissolves boundaries and magnetic cords and liberates these monads so that they can take the outward bound path on the way of the higher evolution. So it is a Neptunian influence likewise which presides over and makes possible the second initiation, probably from a sixth ray aspect, but we cannot necessarily discount the second ray aspect which works through it, and we know that after the second initiation, a lot of the love energy connected with the second ray will be entering the astral body, wherein the initiate produces results in the astral body, and wherein his astral centers are the objects of the Hierophant's attention, and this will be Christ as the initiator will turn his attention to the astral centers. And if he really is working in the egoic lotus, he'll probably deal with those petals which will have their immediate connection to the astral centers. I mean, we just can't know the science of how they apply the energy to produce the effects needed. So this particular type of energy flows through three centers. That particular head center of seven, which is linked to the heart center. Then, and I'm surprised the heart and the head is not here, the heart center itself and the solar plexus. So the heart center bringing in the second ray solar plexus, the sixth ray, and we know that there are seven master centers in the head, whatever their location exactly may be. That could probably be figured out by someone who is more the fifth ray type. So the initiator will probably work with those particular centers, but as the cave of initiation is essentially the egoic lotus, we have to deal with the petals as well and their connection to such things as the man's particular head center, his heart center, and solar plexus center on the etheric levels. And you know, but before that, the astral, the centers on the astral levels. So the planetary planet Neptune, and this is an amazing statement, along with the planetary logos of the sixth ray. What a tricky thing that is, because you think that Neptune is the planetary logos of the sixth ray, controls the astral centers in man. But let's just say that there's all these indications that the secondary monadic ray of Venus is the sixth ray. And its ultimate monadic ray is the second. And in that way, Venus and Neptune are very similar. We have the monadic ray of Neptune said to be the second, but does it have a secondary monadic ray? And is it the second? Is it the sixth? Anyway, this is all on the 2-4-6 line for Neptune, and hence it is not very well applied to the concrete aspects of life, and tends to dissolve our relationship with those concrete aspects. You know, as I see these little paragraphs sort of out of context, I'm just amazed at how supercharged they are with information. I probably gain a lot by reading in context, you know, and that's already been done in a way, because the Anmakara, you will have all kinds of commentaries that are written until we reach the last 100 pages. And I hope that in the future, when people want to study very deeply, that the kind of work I've done, although, you know, I cannot vouch for its complete accuracy. As a matter of fact, I know it's not completely accurate, but that kind of work will help people think connectively and holistically, and yet with meticulous entirety. Meticulous entirety. That gift of the second ray. Now here are some, now we're getting into Esoteric Psychology 1, page 230. And I'm just sure, you know, that there's more references in Cosmic Fire than just a few pointing to the second initiation. Let's see what we're missing. Oh, seven. Well, maybe that's not too bad, actually. Yes, the systemic formula, those cycles, yes. Sanatkumara becomes the agent of the planetary logos, yes. The Lord of the World becomes a great factor, power and love, yes. Yes, we've just looked at that. So I guess maybe we have looked at the various factors which are germane and which are mentioned in the Treatise on Cosmic Fire. I always feel that there's so much more in that book than is written. You know, the book starts out as a book that's written, but if we start putting the thoughts together, it raises us to new levels of revelation, which are not explicit in the book, but are implicit if we make the right kind of combinations of the nuggets of knowledge. So this is something called the correspondences between mineral kingdom and human initiation. Okay, and you know, man is in a way a living stone eventually, just the way the graduates of the planet Vulcan are fiery stones. So we can express what man is as a mineral, perhaps, in relation to a still greater being. You know, the law of correspondences will always hold true, and we can seem to be high in relation to some beings and quite low in relation to others. So the base metals, like lead, let's say, it's a Saturnian metal, relates to the physical plane and dense consciousness and to the first initiation. Well, there's all kinds of disciplining which has to occur under Saturn at that point, and we have to get our density, the three lower subplanes of solid, liquid, and gas under control. The standard metals, I guess we'd need a good alchemist to say what they are, but they're not the precious metals. They relate to the astral plane and to self-consciousness, you know, the growing sense of being a lower ego and an individual. And they relate to the second initiation. We're not yet in the precious stones, are we? The semi-precious stones, these standard metals, I suppose even gold and silver would be included there, even though we consider them to be precious metals. But we've made a jump here to the realm of stone, which is even more compact and higher in its evolution and the pressure to which it has been submitted than are the standard metals. The semi-precious stones to the mental plane and to the radiant consciousness and to the third initiation. Well, I can see that what's really needed here is, you know, some nice fifth-ray type to come along and give us the list of what these what are considered to be the semi-precious stones and so forth. And then the precious stones, and I assume diamond and sapphire and emerald and topaz, is it? And there's that, what is the orange stone? I forget, but anyway, the ruby and the amethyst, you know, these maybe are the precious jewels. And that relates to the egoic consciousness. They've been subjected to a lot of pressure, and they do have to be polished, of course, because they can be in the rough at first. And when they are in the rough, they just don't shine and radiate and are not effective and beautiful the way they are once real attention has been given to them. So, I forget. There's something about Venus and the precious emeralds, the emerald. But even though there's a third ray, green, connected with the emerald, it is one of those that is related to Venus. But I'm forgetting at the moment the name of the orange precious stone. All right, well, someone can correct me or come up with it. Egoic consciousness. And these are the different stages of the human development, just the way they are the stages for the development in the mineral kingdom. There are other divisions, of course, in the mineral kingdom. And maybe we're staying away from that which is liquidic and staying away from that which is gaseous. You know, ultimately, they are related to the mineral kingdom. So anyway, the egoic consciousness and the achievement, finally, of the fourth initiation. So to become a precious stone, to become a diamond soul, as it were, and maybe there are, I think, seven different kinds, colors of diamonds, is like becoming a precious jewel within the human family. And so there's quite a very close correspondence in the development of the human being and the development of members of the mineral kingdom. The correspondences of fire, heat, and pressure in the evolution of the human being are self-evident, and their work can be seen paralleling that in the mineral kingdom. Maybe more exact analogies can be found between man and the mineral than between man and some of the other kingdoms, though, of course, we can find analogies. If we work with that analogic consciousness, and I think that's why DK says the fourth ray is so important in his in the kind of work that he does, because it's a ray which gives us the power of analogy. So where are we? Where are you? Where am I? You know, maybe we're not base metal anymore. And maybe we're moving beyond the standard metals. I suppose copper would be there for Venus. And, well, I don't know, would Mercury there? Mercury be there for Mercury, and lead is dense, you know. So maybe we, even though it relates to a synthesizing planet, in relation to the mineral kingdom, it's a dense factor. Maybe silver has to be considered standard, and even the valuable metals, gold and platinum, have to be considered standard. And then we'd take the leap into stones, which have been subjected to even more fire and heat and pressure. And all of this is the realm of Vulcan, which can provide fire and heat and pressure. We've seen that in these incredible eruptions lately. You know, on the Ring of Fire and the big Hawaiian Island, you know, here it is, 2018, and things are still erupting, and the man who is very busy, I suppose. So can you identify in your life the fires to which you have been subjected? Fire by friction, and then solar fire, and even eventually electric fire. Have things been heating up on the burning ground? Do you feel the pressure which Vulcan applies as you attempt to become more fully human and spiritual? The analogies are really there, and they're very, very interesting. And you can only imagine what the Tibetan's mind is like with this incredible capacity for analogy. I used to think I was pretty good at analogy, and I just about aced this complete test called the Miller's Analogy Test. The only trouble is I didn't know that vodka was produced by potatoes. That was the one thing I got wrong. So I'm trying to develop analogy, analogical thinking, and I hope we're all trying to do that, because it will reveal many hidden factors. Right now, we go further, and on page 70 or 71 of Esoteric Astrology, there's something very similar here. He deals with the second initiation and the three planets which are involved with it, but here he gives us a different point of view. Neptune, Venus, and Jupiter, part of the training for the second initiation. So a disciple who is upon the path is strongly influenced by Mercury and Saturn. I mean, I think these are also planets of maybe accepted discipleship. And eventually we get to the fourth initiation, and again we find Mercury and Saturn, but it helps us discriminate between the dense physical body of the solar logos and the cosmic etheric body of the solar logos. But when he begins his training for the first initiation, he has to contend with the influences of Pluto and Vulcan. And of course, you know, DK describes what this is, and you'll remember it. You know, it's, he says, basically, Mercury and Saturn for the path of discipleship, and the crystallizing and destroying forces of Vulcan and Pluto. Crystallizing in the case of Vulcan, rendering factors which must be destroyed, shatterable, and then destroying forces of Pluto, the true destroyer. The influence of Vulcan reaches to the very depths of his nature, whilst Pluto drags to the surface and destroys all those that hinder in the lower region. And you see, he does go on here to describe the second initiation in terms of Neptune, Venus, and Jupiter, but some different things are said here in Esoteric Psychology 1. So Pluto and Vulcan, and humanity is dealing with Pluto and Vulcan in the last great war. So much destruction, I don't think we're done with it yet. The training for the second initiation brings him under, notice the order here, Neptunian influences. First, it's not exactly in the order of the planets going from the sun, with Venus and Jupiter contending for control. Now, why would they do that? And if you go back to the secret doctrine, you see that Jupiter is ruling the, what kind of fires does he call it? Familial fires. There is somewhat the fire of form, because Jupiter is the exalted planet in Cancer, the sign which has to do with the elemental life. And Venus is related more to Sanat Kumara and to the higher tendencies, which will lift the person away from those familial fires, the things that have to do strictly with the form, and lift up towards the solar angels. So kind of interesting that Jupiter is looked at, I think, in this context, as a lower influence, and Venus, the higher influence. Special names are given in the secret doctrine. I can't remember exactly what they are. I could when I was studying it, but, Venus makes the man, interestingly enough, a celibate, and pulls him away from procreation in the lower worlds. But Jupiter is involving more of these familial, ancestral, procreative fires which trap a man in form. When Venus visits the realm of form, it's as a guest and coming in to stimulate and to enlighten and to show the way through and out. And Jupiter is different. It's involved with the ancestral fires and relates to its exaltation in Cancer. Exaltation is not necessarily a wonderful thing. It just means power. So when Mars is exalted in Capricorn, there's a lot of fighting going on. And when Jupiter is exalted in Cancer, there is a subservience to the form. The link with the vegetable kingdom is then strong, and we have to learn how to become the Saptaparna, you know, the sevenfold plant. And Venus rules the vegetable kingdom, and the vegetable kingdom is the relatively the most developed kingdom for its position. It's a bit like the Christ, you know. Venus, the Christ, and the vegetable kingdom, there are three rays involved with the vegetable kingdom, where the other two, man and animal and mineral, they're just ruled by two rays each. So the link with the vegetable kingdom is then strong, and hence, at this point, the frequent recognition of astral perfumes, which the disciple can note. And when I used to speak to one of, or maybe the last remaining disciple in DK's group, you know, she talked about the different flowers and perfumes associated with various masters, the freesia with Master M and the white rose with Master KH, and maybe it was the carnation with Master DK. At least this was her impression. Okay. And this, well, you know, because when I see Venus and Jupiter contending, they are both planets that really rule the success of the egoic lotus. And you would think that Venus is quality and Jupiter is the expansion of consciousness. And they're both beautifully cooperative together. And in many ways they are sometimes. But they also set themselves in opposition at a certain point. And it's like Nereus for Venus. It's not Nereus. It's like Nereus, and I just can't remember from the secret doctrine how it is, but there is the Venus extracting the soul from the familial ancestral fires, which in a way imprison the soul in form and under the rulership of Jupiter in its relationship to Cancer. So maybe I'll have to look that up at some point. I could do it, but I just don't want to do it right now. The second initiation will be enacted on the astral plane in times to come. The holy place is the place where the second initiation is enacted. Well, all of these are really enacted in the causal body. That is, in a way, the holy place. And this will someday be given on the astral plane when the illusion there persisting has been somewhat dissipated and people can see what's really going on. Over the second initiation, the Christ presides, as was said above, and it is for us the most difficult and most transforming. There it is. There's the word, transforming rather than transmutative, the most transforming of the initiations. The acquiescence of the soul, soul in incarnation, the higher soul, to the demands of the personality for spiritual life, and the submission of the personality to the soul are finding their consummation. So we really say, okay, I'll go, I the personality, I the soul and incarnation will go your way, we say, to the overshadowing and attentive soul. Okay, so interesting that it will be given on the astral plane. Now, the first initiation will be given on the physical plane, and I had thought that it was also possible to offer that initiation, the second, on the physical plane, and somewhere it may say that it is, but it looks like there's a particular focus in this holy place on the astral plane, and once there's been a clearing and one can see with clarity, then maybe this initiation can be attended by those who have the power to do so. So this is the end of second initiation compilation program number 6, and we're here at the 17th of June, and then this will be the beginning, I don't think I can do more tonight, beginning of second initiation compilation program number 7, and not sure when this will happen. I'd love to go on and do it tonight, but some of my friends in the Moria Federation are offering their webinars and so forth, and they do such a good job, you know, that I really have to be there. So, all right. Friends, thank you for your attention. You know, I give what I can. I try to be accurate. I try to be associative. I try to spark new thoughts in the minds of the listener or the onlooker. And some will be accurate and some not as accurate. Some will be leading right to the goal. Some will be maybe a little inadvertently misleading. I just do what I can and offer an expanded, I hope, range of associations for you so the light begins to break forth between perceptions where the light did not before bridge. Okay, that's it then for the moment, and we'll see you a little later. All the best. Lots of love, all the best, and we persist in our study of the second initiation. Okay.